Do you want to be the one to tell him no?
What's he gonna do? Murder me?
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 589 for the week of November 17th, 2025. I am unexpected and financially devastating sewer work, Daver Deagle. I'm here with Little Mind Palace, Sarah D. Bunting.
Mind plumbers ain't free, you know.
Creep shotting tourist star, Ariana.
He'll never know.
And possibly haunted toilet, Stephanie Early Green.
Blush.
I want everybody to refer to me as Daver for the rest
Daver,
of the show.
Sure.
Daver,
sure.
All right, Daver.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, she is a writer and an extra hot great contributor. You've heard with us many times before. It's Stephanie Early Green.
Welcome back, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Delighted to have you here to talk about The Beast in Me, in which Agatha Aggie Wiggs, Claire Danes, is a well-known journalist and memoirist who has been creatively blocked since she experienced a personal tragedy several years ago. Between her inability to get started on her very overdue next book and the failure of the sewer pipes in her handsome old house in Oyster Bay, New York, she's already hanging by a thread when she's disturbed one day by two huge, hostile dogs barking in her yard. And she gets even more disturbed when she finds out that they belong to her new next-door neighbor, Niall Jarvis, Matthew Reese, a New York real estate heir suspected in the disappearance of his first wife, Madison, who is definitely not Robert Durst, so don't even think it. And when it turns out that Niall is trying to get all his neighbors to sign off on the construction of a jogging path in the woods behind their homes, and Aggie is the only holdout, he starts his version of a charm offensive, which leads them into a relationship neither of them expected. Even though it includes characters with book-ass names like Aggie Wiggs and Niall Jarvis, the show is not an adaptation of anything. It was created by Gabe Rotter, previously of the X-Files revivals in 2015 and 2017. Executive producers randomly include Jodie Foster and Conan O'Brien. All 8 episodes dropped on Netflix November 12th. We may talk about events from any of them. Let's do the Chen check-in. Stephanie, should our listeners watch The Beast in Me?
Nah.
Sarah.
Yeah, the whole is less than the sum of the parts somehow, so it's a no for me as well.
Daver.
Oh, well, I like that. Or do I?
Okay.
That's the way I communicate now.
Okay, great. Glad to have Bumblebee with us. It's I did watch it all so that I could have an informed opinion of it, but it is not very good. So I agree with Stephanie and Sarah and question mark Daver. Let's get into it now that we're in the spoiler zone. At this point, Netflix is at about 45% rich people murder shows with Brittany Snow. What do you think is the value prop here that potentially makes it less disposable than The Hunting Wives? And does it actually deliver, Stephanie?
Well, I think the problem is this felt like a mishmash of a bunch of tropes thrown together with great actors, but crappy writing. And there was no through line. I mean, it was like, let's follow this thread. No, let's follow this thread. No, let's follow this thread. And it really felt like they were just trying to, like an algorithm built this show and they were just trying to like check boxes so that, well, if you don't like the creepy neighbor plotline, you'll like the real estate development plotline. And if you don't like that plotline, maybe you'll like the drunk FBI agent plotline. And if you don't like that plotline, maybe you'll like the dead kid plotline. Mm-hmm. And so it really felt just like a mishmash of stuff that never cohered into something with an actual plot or thrust, I guess.
Sarah, what did you think?
I'm with Stephanie. There's just like, it was all hats and then like a person on the hat instead of like a hat on a hat. I mean, the acting is good, but there was just too much backstory that like of all lead actors not to trust to make just a straightforward, like, I think my shitwit neighbor killed his wife plot interesting. Mm-hmm. You don't need this backstory. You don't need her success to have come from this like crime noir about her con man dad. But like, if you are going to throw that in there, make that part of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was totally dropped.
Have him played by Jeremy Irons, like something else. And I was just very frustrated that the writing, it didn't trust itself. And I guess it was right not to, but it also didn't trust the actors to just like, here's four episodes maybe, or six. Here is a sort of Durst-ish plot line. And then just, I don't know, have them play it out. Like, you don't have to have every single thing happen to people. And also like the vague sense that a tiny fluffy dog named Stever was in danger. I was like, I don't need this in my life right now.
Can report Stever is fine. There's other than a pee accident when Aggie is away from the house for too long. He thrives.
He did a wee-wee.
I mean, who amongst us?
Dave, you were early out on this one as well. How did it not grab you?
Well, look, I didn't need to watch this because when it comes to living next door to an alleged local mob boss, I've lived that life. And let me tell you, this didn't feel like that at all. Interesting backstory not inserted here. Not sure if it would get back to the people I'm talking about, and they would kill me in a very unique Hawaiian style. Oops. I've said too much already. They were nice, but
to us.
Anyway, so that's why I thought The Beast in Me didn't really capture, you know, what it's like.
Sure.
But anyways, my real takeaway is you've got 8 hours to get through this not terribly complicated story.
Yeah.
And it's not tight or a deep enough character study to make up for that.
Right. I'll also say episode 7 is the classic, like, and here's a flashback to events that happened before the start of the series.
We don't need that.
Such a lazy crutch.
Stop that.
And what happens in it is basically what you think happened.
Aliens.
Huge spoiler. Oh. Well, I won't spoil it, but what you think happened with the wife is what you see.
Is what happened.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, you could have just had us find this out another way. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Or not.
Between Sarah's study of true crime and Stephanie's study of non-competition reality TV, both of you have seen lots of depictions of malignant narcissists, sociopaths, and psychopaths on screen. What did you think the writing and performance of Niall got right, Sarah?
I had in my notes that it was giving this boss I used to have, like, seriously 30 years ago, who was a, like, internationally ranked Wing Sun fighter and actually was deported back to Austria, I think, for causing, like, literally a rumble in Midtown with a rival fighting school, as one does. And when I first was hired to work at this electronic publishing concern, he would take me to lunch like every week and just be that kind of undermining, I thought you'd be more self-assured, full of comments like that, while also urging me to drink a lot at lunch, which if I am not eager to do that, you're doing it wrong. Like, you're doing lunch wrong. So it was serving real nepo, overconfident, white guy, magnate vibes to me. I thought the performance was successful. What I question is whether we need that. Do we need that again?
Right.
And like, he's not, I think it was Daniel Feinberg who pointed out in his review, like, this iteration of Durst is never going to be as like creepily compelling and oddball-y as the original. So what are we doing here? But yeah, I thought it was a good performance. And you can always see Matthew Rhys kind of working, and I enjoy that. This particular role is just not something I need more of in my life.
Stephanie, you agree? You're nodding.
Yeah, I agree. Side note, it's interesting you guys keep saying he's like a Durst stand-in, because I immediately thought of it's like Pholos Doulos, the one who murdered his wife Jennifer Doulos. Sarah, do you know this?
Yes.
Case. That's who I thought he was supposed to be. But I guess any rich guy who murders his wife, they're all kind of the same. Anyway, I agree. Performance great. I love Matthew Rhys. Yeah. I think he's so cute. I think he can normally do nothing wrong in my book. And it's not his fault. I think it's just the writing of the show. And he did his absolute best with it. I was compelled when he was on screen, except during the interminable real estate development scenes and all the stuff with the like AOC stand-in lady. I was like, oh, this is so boring. Why is this in the show? Like, but again, not my Matthew's fault. He did what he could.
Yeah, I appreciated how in his first couple of interactions with Aggie, he's like reflexively trying to charm her. But then as when it can, he can tell it's not working, he just drops it and switches to hostility like immediately. But also knows the best gift he can give her is a dead Tenny Pfennig on her doorstep, like a like a sparrow brought back by a cat. I'll also say the greatest gift Robert Durst's dead ass ever got was that a character even inspired by him is being played by Matthew Rhys, who is hotter than Robert Durst on his hottest day.
Yeah, and like a foot taller as well.
That too. Yeah. But seeing him on screen again, Matthew Rhys, in the same season that we're watching Chris Chalk in Welcome to Derry makes me sad about Perry Mason. Justice for Perry Mason. We never got enough. Are we, as a culture, arriving at the end of what we can discover in a chin-trembly Claire Danes performance? Sarah, I'm going to go to you first as the expert from my so-called Lifetimes.
Oh, my God. And I recapped, like, all of Homeland. God fucking help me. Yeah, I think we are. But I think that, at least, the show understood and, like, literally opens on that classic, like, controlled demolition face of hers happening. Mm-hmm. You may as well lean in. To it. I thought she was good too, but I do think that we have reached the end of that, of the Tremblechin's useful life on its own.
Tremblechin's. And I just. Chin skin.
Yeah. I just kind of felt like, why can't we have Aggie Wiggs PI? She just is being, she and Steve are just like being nosy in their extremely cozy and expensive looking sweaters, and then just do that.
My grandfather worked down at the Claire Danes mines, and my father worked down in the Claire Danes mines, but now those mines are empty of Tremble.
They might be now. She does it in every episode except for the seventh one, where we only see her like in a flashback to 2019 when she's happy.
Oh no, Dad's got the lung.
Yeah, I don't need to see her as a PI, but one of my favorite moments in the pilot is when she's talking to her editor when she gets to the part where it's like, you'll never guess who moved in next door to me. She just like lights up to get to tell this gossip. And it's like, let us see her in that mode. That's so much more fun.
Yeah. Smug or happy.
Yeah.
Maybe something like not teetering on the brink of nervous collapse.
Yeah.
Role might be fun for her and us.
They would have to get rid of the ex-wife and the dead kid to do that. I also could have done with fewer scenes of her mouth chewing. I mean, I guess those are redundant. Just chewing, swallowing, slurping. There were so many scenes within the first 10 minutes of the show that triggered my misophonia so bad. I was like putting the volume all the way down. Like, why? And then there's a scene of Matthew Rhys eating a chicken, which reminded me of Sarah's
God, that scene was disgusting. Pick.
That's, yeah.
Well, nothing is all bad, right?
So, yeah, it felt like filler. Like, why is this supposed to be a symbol? Like, why do we need to see these people close up eating so much?
Yeah.
Small complaint, but.
That chicken scene was worthy of Welcome to Derry.
Yeah.
It was so disgusting.
It really was.
It was so just like, it looked like it was cooked slightly wrongly. And it was just it was too juicy and oily. Everything about it drove me crazy.
Well, speaking of worthy of Welcome to Derry, the sewer pipes backing up at Aggie's house.
Yeah. Been there.
Dave, are you okay? This was triggering for both of us, I think.
This is a recent event in our lives that really cascaded into a big headache.
As it were.
In the literal shit show.
Yes. Yeah, it's a literal shit show. I feel like that would be her number one issue, and then everything else with the mob boss would be number two, as it were. Because it really just, it sucks you into its orbit and doesn't let go until it is done. There's no like half fixing sewer lines under your house. There's no half putting up with it. It's just like it takes over your whole life. So priorities were wrong in the show, but sticking your head in the sink and then being sprayed with shit, I mean, every day for a while.
Ours was not that bad, thank God. But I mean, it's clearly everyone who comes in the house can smell it. It's like, ma'am, put your book aside.
Yeah.
Sell this house.
Yeah.
Deal with your literal shit. But I feel like the truest sign that she's falling apart is that she hesitates for a second to take Niall up on his suggestion that she write a book about him. Like, do you hate money? Obviously, you have to do this. Doy.
Yeah.
And, you know, no one wants that book about RBG and Scalia. please no one get the idea from the show and actually write it, because no one wants to read it. No one wants to see it.
You can just turn that into a 70s cop TV show. Just take those names, totally rewrite the rest of it.
That does feel like an Adult Swim show that could have happened in the 20-teens. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, anything else to add? The show was very Netflix derogatory, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hope the check's cleared. Good luck.
Fangled stories on my electric story box.
Hey!
All right, it's time for Around the Dial, talking about what we've been watching on TV recently. First up, Tara.
Hello. We have talked in the past about Alan Partridge, the character played by Steve Coogan and originated by him and Armando Iannucci in the radio spoof On the Hour. He initially came to TV in the Day Today spoof of news magazine shows and returned there every few years in projects with and without Iannucci. These have ranged from heavily produced parodies like Knowing Me, Knowing You with Alan Partridge in the style of a talk variety show to more straightforward sitcoms like I Am Alan Partridge. And if you followed me on Twitter in the late 20-teens or early 2020s, you've interacted with This Time with Alan Partridge, a parody of breakfast television shows, because that's where the gif of Alan throwing out a whole fridge drawer full of vegetables that I used to tweet every Friday came from. When a new show was announced for 2025, I didn't know anything about it except that I would definitely be watching it. And so in How Are You? I'm Alan, parentheses Partridge, which has been in the works since 2019, we find out Alan recently broke down in the middle of hosting a corporate event at an animal feed company, probably due to stress, which is apparently the first time he has ever had occasion to think about mental health. Naturally, the best way for him to process this is by styling himself as an expert and making a 6-part documentary series about it, sponsored by Norwich's own Flench and Son Tanning Centers. And as the series goes on, we learn what has changed in Alan's life since we saw him last. He is dating a neighbor named Katrina, who has an extraordinarily close relationship with her badminton partner, Daryl. Alan's done a lot of broadcasting work in Saudi Arabia, including endorsing a local brand of camel milk. What he has not really done is grow, which is confirmed in the first episode when he reunites with his radio punching bag sidekick Simon, played by Tim Key from the first season of Taskmaster, among many other credits, the paper as well. And this is what happens when they try to clear the air. Let's hear the clip.
When you criticize me on air, I feel belittled.
When you complain about feedback, I feel hurt because I'm only trying to help you.
Right, well, when you say feedback, but then reel off a lot of quibbles you have with me, I feel attacked.
Yeah. When you describe major flaws in your broadcasting style as quibbles, I feel you're not taking the listener seriously.
When you talk about the listeners, I feel like you're hiding behind them in order to say a lot of petty gripes that have been bothering you that day.
When you describe my gripes as petty, I feel like you're being a dick and it hurts my feelings.
When you call me a dick, I want to tell you to fuck off and say that when you worked here, no one at the station liked you.
When you use bad language and lie, I feel like I shouldn't have given you the day off when your dad died.
As of now, American viewers can only watch this if they fly to England, but I imagine some service will pick it up soon. At one point, HBO Max had all of the Alan Partridge shows, and we rewatched them all, and that was a wonderful time. But it's worth making the journey. I do already have an episode from this season on my to canon list for 2026. Dave, you watched this as well.
Yep, I concur.
Great! For my plug, this is my last chance. This is our last regular episode that we are taping before our break. My last chance to promote Street Forum, the group that I've been volunteering with. There's a link in the show notes so you can donate to the mutual aid work that they do here in Austin. Or I encourage everyone to look for groups that are doing mutual aid in your own communities and find out how you can help them financially, especially at this time of year.
All right, Stephanie, what have you been watching people need to know about?
Okay, well, I would be remiss if I didn't use my Around the Dial segment to talk about Married at First Sight,
woo!
A favorite of Tara and myself, which is currently in its 19th season, yes, and it's now on Peacock. It used to be on Lifetime, Lifetime. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it's better than ever. They've cut out all the matchmaking and other lead-up fluff that used to drag on for several episodes in past seasons, and now we get right into the weddings in the first episode. So I'm loving the season for two main reasons. One, as I said, it moves along quickly without much pontificating from the experts, a group of people who are provably terrible at their one job and thus do not deserve more of a platform than they already have. And two, there's an interesting mix of ages represented among the cast this time, which they haven't done before. So it turns out having some boomers and some Gen Xers in the mix adds some interesting texture to the show. And age diversity aside, the casting this season is pretty great. There is a giant spoiler about one of these couples that I will avoid, but please just know that it is really hard for me not to spoil this for you because it's so bad.
I think you can say it. The show, if it's aired, you've seen it. Okay, it's not a spoiler anymore.
Well, I don't want to ruin it for you. You know, one of the couples gets pregnant after knowing each other for like 30 seconds.
Guys.
And they are a couple that is so doomed already. Mm-hmm. So I won't say more than that, but let me go over the couples roughly in age order, if I may. And I know that you've gone over them before, Tara, but I have a slightly different take on a couple of these people after watching
so much more.
I've watched all the episodes.
Yeah.
Okay. So Jalen and Josh, they're in their 20s. They're both physically attractive, both extremely bland. Their biggest issue is that his whole personality is Burning Man and her whole personality is spinning and never the twain shall meet. People on Reddit seem to absolutely despise this man, but I can't really scratch up much feeling about him either way. Mm-hmm. Like, he's fine.
Yeah.
And she's also fine, but also they probably shouldn't be married.
Does Reddit hate her or hate him because he gave her a post nup?
No, well, that's a bone of contention, but they mostly hate him because he's so obsessed with Burning Man is like really sad that she doesn't want to go to Burning Man with him. And they have this ridiculous like argument about what does community mean? And for him, community equals Burning Man.
Right.
And for her, community equals spinning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're not going to resolve that one today. So they, of all the couples, they're probably the least doomed. But as you'll see as I go on, that's a very low bar.
Yep.
Second, we have Brittany and Will. These two are in their 30s, early 30s, and their defining features are as follows. Brittany has never had a serious boyfriend before and has such long nails that I worry about everyone's like ocular safety when she is gesticulating. Mm-hmm. Will, meanwhile, shows very little emotion and seems utterly uninterested in Brittany and the whole process in general, to the point where, and I said this to Tara, I do wonder if he's neurodivergent in some way, but of course that's never addressed on the show. And I feel like if Brittany and Will could sit down and have an honest conversation about his ability to emote or like give her anything, maybe they would have a chance, but they talk past each other. And anyway, never going to have that conversation. They're doomed. Mm. Then we have Megan and Derek. They're both 38. They both spell their name stupidly with extra letters. They're both blonde.
Right. I remember this.
Yes. And this is about the extent of what they have in common. Mm-hmm. She's a spoiled brat who walks all over him, and he's a doormat who's so desperate to be married, he puts up with her bullshit. And I lost all respect for him as soon as I saw how like nice and accommodating he is to her when she's being an absolute nightmare. Mm-hmm. So they're doomed. Then we have Belinda and Chad. As Tara mentioned, I think in the previous episode, one of the big twists in episode one is that Belinda, age 47, is actually Jalen's mother. She's also exceedingly bland and is matched with Chad, who seems to simmer with barely contained rage at all times and threatens to quit the show in episode 11 because the production schedule is too disruptive.
He also drinks a lot.
To be honest, respect. Like, I mean, I would probably feel the same, but Chad has some red flags. Like, this is his fourth marriage, and he drinks himself to sleep every night. So good luck, Belinda. It should probably go without saying at this point, but doomed. Mm-hmm. And finally, the biggest disaster out of all these couples, Rhonda and Pat. Rhonda is 63 and on her third marriage. Pat is 59 and on his second. Early on, Rhonda seemed like a good communicator who'd done enough therapy to know how to have like a difficult conversation. But within a few episodes, it becomes apparent that she's actually criminally self-involved, hypercritical, and will not let Pat get a word in edgewise unless that word is in some way referencing Rhonda and how wonderful she is. She shares anecdotes from her frankly boring life and then quizzes Pat about what he learned about her. And if he dares to try to relate to anything she says with like an anecdote of his own, she berates him. Pat, meanwhile, has become a shell of a man, and he's trying so hard to adhere to Rhonda's impossible rules, but can't. And their scenes are absolutely excruciating to watch. And I've watched all 19 seasons of the show, and I'd say Rhonda's going on my short list of terrible contestants, whatever you want to call them, participants, right up there in the pantheon with that guy who got another lady pregnant while he was on the show, and the woman who got arrested in the airport for evading like a warrant for identity theft.
That was so good.
So, So that's Married at First Sight. Decision Day is fast approaching. The finale airs November 20th, which is the day after tomorrow record this. I can't wait. I'm locked in. So that's that.
I have so much to catch up on.
Yeah, so much. You gotta catch up when you can, Kara. Mm-hmm. You can check out my website, stephanieearlygreen.com, to see my latest short fiction publications. I just had a story come out this fall on Gulf Coast, and then I also write dumb humor stuff sometimes. So I had a thing in Points in Case yesterday, which is extremely short and dumb, but it's all on my website, so you can read it there.
Yay. And hear you every other month on Extra Extra Hot Grade.
Yes.
All right, Sarah, what do you got?
Speaking of criminally, it is sort of JFK week over at bestevidence.fyi. Going back to look at some properties that I've missed over the years, some more obscure crackpotty stuff that will include the miniseries starring Martin Sheen as JFK. But I also found a pretty decent documentary, to my surprise, called JFK, What the Doctor Saw, which is just what it says on the tin. And for the subgenre, it's actually rather impressive, especially for one that came out 60 years after events, because JFK assassination properties have a threefold problem, starting with the 60 plus years on part of the case file. The second thing is that there really is no new information that is credible. And the third thing is that any new theory on or interpretation of the information that we do have is inevitably going to sound like a parody of the entire cases like crackpot industrial complex. Granted, most of the old theories and interpretations sound like that also. But this threefold problem actually makes it really easy to review stuff at this point in the case's history. It's often tiresome to sit through them just in case, but the occasional wheat stalk in the chaff is a cinch to spot as a result. And What the Doctor Saw is an essential viewing, but it is pretty good because it's some different AV assets for once. Nothing super groundbreaking, but footage you don't always see, radio reports you don't always hear. It reminded me that Geraldo Rivera actually used to be good at this, like he cared about and got stories nobody else bothered with. Like, America was introduced to the Zapruder film on his show, Good Night America. We'll link that in the show notes. Also, he had fucking amazing hair. Geraldo, what happened? It's also good because it stays focused, unlike your correspondent. It doesn't get bogged down in theories that sound insane. It just notes the discrepancies and lets the viewer fill in the blanks. Like I said, not necessary to watch it, but if you're interested in that subset of unofficial information on JFK's assassination, it is on Paramount Plus. It's not flawless, but I recommend it. And if you would like to do some more reading on the case or any other major case, those materials are on sale at Exhibit B Books for the rest of the month. Get your D.B. Cooper on, 20% off. Cart does not believe in a magic bullet, but does automagically do the math on that discount. ExhibitBBooks.com.
All right, buckle up. Here's what we'll be offering for you in the weeks ahead. We've got this Friday, A Man on the Inside, Season 2. We've got Jingle Bell Heist. We've got 2025 Guest Thought Experiments. We have Apple TV's The Hunt, known in France as Le Hunt.
Okay.
We've got the 2025 edition of Mullen Dash. We've got an All Canons episode. We've got the Rhapsody Street Kids Believe in Santa Christmas Forsetting. Oh, in brackets, you bastard. Mm-hmm. We've got December 1980 commercial compilation coverage, superhero bracket. We've got William Shatner in The $6 Million Man. We've got a Would You Rather episode. We've got Whiz Kids in another force inning, and then we'll be back live in the studio when we cover The Pit Season 2 with Heather Cox. Woo! It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon presenting. This week is our guest, Stephanie. Stephanie, take it away.
Okay, I was a big fan of the first 5 seasons of The Office, the U.S. version. In season 4, the writing was incredible. The cast was perfect in that no character had yet crossed over into caricature territory, and we hadn't yet reached the stage where anyone had to learn or grow in any way, which in my opinion soured later seasons of the show. Also, and this is my personal bugaboo, Jim and Pam had not yet curdled into an obnoxious, holier-than-thou Scranton power couple. There are so many great episodes from this particular season of The Office, but Dinner Party sticks out as an obvious winner. Let's start with the efficient table setting in the first 2 minutes of the episode. Clip one.
You have plans tonight?
Nope, I don't. Remember when you told us not to make plans because we were working?
Yes, I remember. This is BS. This is BS. Why are we here? I am going to call corporate. Enough is enough. I'm so mad. This is Michael Scott, Scranton. Well, we don't want to work. No, we don't. It's not fair to these people. These people are my friends and I care about them. We're not going to do it. Everybody, I just got off the horn with corporate. And basically, I told them where they could stick their little overtime assignment. Go enjoy your Friday.
Thank you, Michael. All right. Happy Friday.
Well, I think we dodged a bullet there.
I think you did.
I think we should celebrate. How about you, Pam, Mikasa, little dinner, dancing, drinks? You said you didn't have plans.
Michael is forcing Jim and Pam to come to dinner against their will, and we know this will be disastrous, but the genius of this episode is the specific way in which this dinner party spirals into chaos. The next scene cuts to Jim and Pam arriving at Michael's condo, which he now shares with his girlfriend and former boss, Jan. The weird dynamics between Pam and Jan start immediately when Pam hands Jan a bottle of wine and Jan says it will be great to cook with. So bitchy. The tension between Pam and Jan culminates later in the episode in Jan accusing Pam of being in love with Michael. And this doesn't even come close to being the most uncomfortable interaction at this dinner party. The evening starts with a toxic house tour for Jim and Pam. Jan has moved into Michael's condo and clearly hates everything about it. The house tour makes clear, A, how completely Jan has commandeered Michael's space, and B, how deeply these two people resent each other. Literally, every room of the condo reveals another layer of relationship dysfunction, from the fact that Jan has an office and a workspace for her candle-making enterprise, Serenity by Jan, to their dispute over whether the wall in the bedroom should be white versus eggshell white, to the fact that Michael sleeps curled on a tiny bench at the foot of their bed because of Jan's, quote, space issues. Pam and Jim are clearly in hell, and soon Andy and Angela show up, and the condo tour begins anew. And that's clip two.
Well, how about we do the short tour, and then I'll start dinner?
Oh, I can help starting dinner if you need it.
Oh, no, just the ossobuco needs to braise for about 3 hours. Everything else is done.
3 hours from now or 3 hours from earlier, like 4 o'clock?
You know, Pam, in Spain, they often don't even start eating until midnight.
When in Rome.
So since dinner won't be ready until like 11 at the earliest, Jan and Michael entertain their guests with music, games, and conversation, all of which make it obvious how much they despise each other. As everyone waits for the ossobuco to braise, Jan insists on putting on some music, and that's clip three.
Do you guys remember my old assistant, Hunter? He is an excellent songwriter. Wait till you hear this. Okay, here we go.
You took me by.
So there was simply no way I could not clip that entire portion of the song. I love so much about this scene. The fact that the lyrics to that song clearly suggest not only did Jan and Hunter bang, but that she took his virginity. Jan's weird solo dancing, her attempt to get Jim to dance, and Jim's steadfast refusal to engage. Things take a turn when Dwight, who was explicitly not invited to this couple's party, ostensibly because Jan and Michael didn't have enough wine glasses, shows up with a lady friend, bearing his own picnic basket full of food and, yes, wine glasses. Jan wants to turn them away, but Michael wants to let them in, and this leads to an argument right in front of Dwight and his friend, who are standing in the threshold. This is kind of a long clip, but it's the last one, and I think it's worth it. It's clip four.
Fine. So, whatever you want. Just like always. Whatever you want.
Whatever I want. It's never whatever I want.
It's fine.
When I wanted to see Stomp and you wanted to see Wicked, what did we see?
We saw...
When I said that I wanted to have kids and you said that you wanted me to have a vasectomy, what did I do? And then when you said that you might want to have kids and I wasn't so sure, who had the vasectomy reversed? And then when you said you definitely didn't want to have kids, who had it reversed back? Snip, snap, snip, snap, snip, snap. I did. Okay. You have no idea the physical toll the three vasectomies have on a person. And I bought this condo to fill with children.
I am so sorry that I don't want to bring kids into this screwed up world, okay?
But look,
if you want to have kids, then fine. You win. Let's have a f***ing kid.
Do you mean it? You want to have a kid?
I hate my life.
So, can we come in?
By the way, I can't think of a more Michael-coded show than Stomp. That's just so perfect, that little detail. Finally, dinner is ready. Jan brings out the food separately for Pam and Michael after Michael whispers to Pam that he thinks Jan might be trying to poison him. Things come to a head during dinner after Michael reinstalls his St. Pauli Girl neon beer sign over the dinner table, and Jan destroys Michael's prize $200 plasma TV by throwing a Dundee at it. The cops come and the party disperses, and we go out on the dulcet tones of Hunter. So before I get into my actual pitch for this episode, I want to note that a lot of the jokes in this episode are visual. So there's reaction shots, for example, Pam's horror when she realizes how long dinner is going to be, as well as shots of the decor and objects in the condo. For example, Michael's extremely proud of his plasma TV, which is approximately 8 by 10 inches and mounted awkwardly on the wall diagonally above the fireplace. Or there's the brief shot. Oh, there's the table Michael made with the nails sticking out of it. There's a brief shot of a giant pop art of Jan's face hanging in the stairway. None of this comes through in the clips, but the visual humor in this episode is at least, I don't know, 50% of why it works so well. Apart from that, here's why I think this episode should immediately be inducted into the canon. Joke density. This is always an important metric for me when I'm nominating comedy for the canon. There are so many little throwaway lines in here that I didn't clip, but that made me chortle, like when Michael's dipping his meat in his wine and Jan tells him to stop because it's disgusting. And he reminds her that he has, quote, soft teeth. The writing at this point in this show's lifespan was on point. I also love that this episode is a showcase for the relationship dynamics between various couples, Andy and Angela, Jim and Pam, Dwight and his former babysitter, and also, of course, Dwight and Angela, and most crucially, Jan and Michael. Judicious use of side characters. Dwight, Andy, and Angela are all used just the right amount. In later seasons of The Office, the side characters often got too much airtime, which ultimately led to the inflation of certain, like, funny character attributes into all-out caricature. Here we just get a little soupçon of Andy, like when he immediately decides to invest in Jan's candle company after like 2 seconds of deliberation. And Dwight is a great foil to Michael without sucking all the air out of the room. And finally, the premise is universal, but the execution is specific. We've all been to dinner parties where the food comes out late, the conversation is stilted or boring, and there are tense relationship dynamics at play. But the specifics of the relationship between Jan and Michael are what make this episode so funny. I think about Michael's tiny plasma TV and Serenity by Jan and her bonfire-scented candle at least once a year. And this episode originally aired in 2008. So to me, that is staying power. And the fact that it still made me laugh on my rewatch are strong arguments for its canon worthiness. And I hope you'll agree that Dinner Party deserves a place in the Extra Hot Great canon.
Stephanie, thank you so much. Let's go to Sarah first.
You're so right about the joke density and the visual humor. There's also a shot as we're being introduced to the concepts that Michael has to sleep like in the fetal position on this bench. There's like an acre of pillows on the bed and like just the strip of mattress, which like, look, I have too many pillows everywhere and I get it. But there's also a tripod with a camera on it that is like hastily put out of the way. They're like, I thought I told you to clean up. But I don't think I had seen this episode before, and I was struck by, and I know this is like my husband's favorite show. He has gotten an episode into the canon. He drinks out of a Dunder Mifflin mug. I'm a bad wife. But we don't do this Jan Michael shit in front of company. And like the Jan Michael dynamic, like I
Tara definitely, and probably also Dave. There's a specific Ontarian couple that we've yes, been is. Around that it's like, oh my God. Like yeah. I just was having absolute PTSD with that. But that moment, if for no other reason, but that moment when you realize that a dinner party that you don't want to be at, A, which B, is even worse than you sort of like doomed out in your head on the way there, is not even really going to start the dinner part for another like 4 hours. And there's only the bottle of wine you brought. It's like, oh my God, like just seeing Pam's entire soul, like aerosolizing as she realizes this, it was like, oh my God, that's so relatable. There's also that specific guy who doesn't fucking understand how celebrity or charades work. And it's like, you know, he looks like Tom Cruise. And you're like, oh my God, it's like, if the clues, do you understand why you can't do it like that? No, they don't. Rule police like me and Tara hate that shit at a party. Angela was really tough for me to take most of the Office episodes I have watched, but her like, what am I supposed to do with this with the flower? Really line. Spoke to me.
Yeah.
That it was just like, yeah, this is the thing about flowers. Like they just require things of the recipient. And you're just like, I can't, what do you want me to do with this now? Like justice for Angela in that moment. Yeah, this really was brilliant and such a, like, again, joke dense assembly of like the various horrors that can be inflicted on you at an awkward party. And Revelator, he's like, I think she's trying to poison me. And then Pam's in the bathroom like, but I think now she's trying to poison me. Probably. And then that wonderful car talk moment for them where they're like, let's just go get food and listen to this CD that we stole for the benefit of everyone. Mm-hmm. Excellent presentation. And I mean, this is like a ton of tiny canon moments all in the same episode. And that's what we're here for. So thank you very much for bringing this to us. Who is next?
I'll go next. My reaction wasn't, you're a bad wife for not watching it. It was like, oh, you're so lucky that you got to watch this for the first time. Because I love this episode too. Dwight is definitely one of the characters that tipped into caricature probably faster than any of the others. And, you know, he had less of a distance to travel there. But his interview in the cold open where he's talking about not being invited because he's not in a couple and then starting to cry was my first actual LOL of the episode. You're also so right about the visual jokes. A few more that I noted. When Andy takes his coat off and he has a sweater over his shoulders already under his coat. it's a scarf.
Didn't even notice that.
That love Dwight's date is Beth, played by Beth Grant, who is, you know, at least 30 years older than he is at this point. And at the end, when Dwight is bringing Michael back to his place to stay because he's had this fight with Jan that the cops have had to be called to because they were so loud, Dwight's date is sitting at the bus stop. And they just pretend not to see her. And also Jim's reaction when they go to Jan's workspace with all of her candles, where it's like, it smells so strong and so awful that he just turns to the camera and is like trying to catch his breath. Yeah. But the rest of it, like you said, the joke density is insane. It's not only, by the way, I feel like I should stress that Jan thinks that Pam is in love with Michael, is that she thinks they dated because Michael has said they were together. And that's the first reference that Pam understands exactly what's happening is when Jan is complaining to the ladies about what a mess Michael makes when he takes a bath. And it's like, well, Pam, you know. And she's like, yeah, what? She's just going along to get along and then realizes what she has agreed to. It's all so good. And I have to give it up. I mean, Michael says he doesn't see Hunter's talent, but when I was trying to fall asleep last night, the Hunter song was running through my head. it's very catchy.
Yeah.
So excellent presentation. Beautiful choice. I loved it. Dave.
Yeah, I agree with everything. I think the peak of this episode is Jan dancing to that song. Just those like 17 seconds between that and trying to get Jim to dance. It was just like, this episode to me, the only thing I want to add is this episode to me feels like the closest they've come to a pure Office UK DNA episode. Mm-hmm. If you like this episode a lot, there's a whole, and you haven't watched Office UK, it's like mostly this.
Yeah.
All right, so let's make this official. Sarah D. Bunting, what say you about Dinner Party? Can it worthy or not?
Just making people laugh. It's a yes for me.
Dara?
That's what she said. Me too.
All right, and me. So. The Office, Season 4, Episode 13, Dinner Party. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time to discover who is the winner and who is the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. It is Peter Morgan's reimagining of The Boys from Brazil for TV. It is officially a go at Netflix. Jeremy Strong and Gillian Anderson are among those attached / starring. I feel like I've been spending a lot more time with properties of the mid-70s lately, mm-hmm. and going back to something like that, that literally that book was in every parent's bookshelf somewhere. Seeing what they do with it half a century later is really going to be fascinating, I think, especially in the current climate. So yeah, good for everyone involved. Interested to see what they do with it.
And who is our loser, Tara?
Well, the loser is the show The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, not because it was canceled or anything, but because one of its stars, Whitney Levitt, has admitted that she quit Secret Lives and then only returned so that she would have enough juice to get cast on Dancing with the Stars, where she currently is and currently killing it. Apparently, she's a wonderful dancer. I have learned from one of the podcasts I listen to that I won't mention because that bothers Dave for some reason, but that apparently ballroom dancing is like huge with Mormons. This is why like the Huffs are so ascendant. And so it's a thing in the Mormon community. And apparently Whitney is extraordinarily good. So good for her, bad for Secret Lives, which sounds absolutely abysmal every time I hear about it.
Well, speaking about being absolutely abysmal, every time you think about it.
There you go.
Do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
It's game time. Game time. This is the third game time of the season. Scores are Tara with 2. Everybody else still looking to get on the board. Today we are playing The Beasts in Me, me being TV. In this game, you will be tasked with identifying the name of a TV show with an animal species in the title. Not a pet name, the name of a species. So not Lassie, but dog. Everyone will play each question, with the person guessing first changing every question. I will give you the 7th billed actor in that show, according to IMDb. If you don't get it, play moves to the next player with the 6th billed actor, and so on and so on. If we get actually to number one without anybody guessing it right, that means we're back to the top of the batting order. So that's a little benefit of going first. You get to go last too. All right, 1 point per correct answer. And let's start to picky to see that guessing order today.
We will start with Tara.
All right, so the order will be Tara, Sarah, Stephanie. Please remember who you are after so we can keep play moving. 18 questions, no steel meals. We'll see about a challenger zone in the middle. Are we ready to play The Beasts in Me, me being TV?
Yes.
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 All right, so Tara will start. If she doesn't get it, goes to Sarah, then to Stephanie. The 7th billed actor on this TV show that has an animal in the title is Richard Delane.
Pass.
Dicky Dill. No. All right. Sarah, you've got Kate Phillips.
Is this Benson? I don't know.
Yes. Famous animal, Benson. Claire Foy for Stephanie. Claire Foy.
I know her from The Crown, but that's not an animal.
Back to Tara. Josh Porter.
I believe this is Wolf Hall.
This is Wolf Hall. Oh, yeah. Yes, Wolf Hall. We had Mark Rylance, Damian Lewis, all those guys at the top of that one. All right.
Okay, 1 point.
1 point.
Okay.
We're going to start with Sarah now. 7th billed on this show, Stanley Fafara or farfara, maybe. I don't know. Fa-fa-ra. Fa-fa-ra. Ra-ra. Fa-fa-ra.
Terriers.
Mm. It's good to guess something. You never know. Six build. Robert Rusty Stevens.
Pass.
Tutara. Mm. Ken Osman.
Black Sheep Squadron.
Mm. Back to Sarah. Tony Dow.
The Sopranos? Come on.
To Stephanie, Hugh Beaumont.
Pass.
To Tara, Jerry Mathers.
Leave It to Beaver.
Leave It to Beaver is correct. All right. We're going to start with Stephanie on this question with Megan Mullally, seventh build. TV show that has an animal species type, something like that in the title, but not pet names.
I don't know. Pass.
Tutara, Buddy Hackett.
Oh, it's not what I thought at all. Mayor of Easttown.
To Sarah, Robert Guillaume. It's not Benson. Don't guess Benson. It's not Benson.
I'm not going to guess Benson.
She trapped herself in the corner.
Sports Nate.
I'm sorry.
Back to Stephanie with Hector Elizondo.
I don't know.
All right. To Tara, Tim Curry.
Cock-a-clue.
Sarah, Georgia Brown.
Slow horses.
I don't know.
And number one build for Stephanie is Asner. Ed Asner.
It's not coming to me.
All right, nobody gets that point. Dan Cassino very upset with you all because this is Fish Police.
Oh, God.
Fish Police. Jesus.
I had no idea that Ed Asner was top billed in Fish Police.
All right. Yeah. Let's get to question number four. We're starting with Tara. Mm-hmm. Your seventh build is Larry Minetti.
Pass.
All right. To Sarah, Jeff McKay.
Jeff McKay.
Very agreeable.
Frisky Dingo.
To Stephanie, W.K. Stratton.
I don't know.
Back to Tara, Dirk Blocker.
Pass.
To Sarah, Dana Elkar.
I know he was in The Sting. The Bee Sting?
Stephanie with our second build, Simon Oakland.
No idea.
All right. And to Tara with our last clue, Robert Conrad.
Baba Black Sheep?
Baba Black Sheep is correct. Or Black Sheep Squadron.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, same show.
Oh.
1 point. All right.
Great.
Next question starts with Sarah. You've got Brian Forster.
Brian Forster. Thundercats. Ho.
To Stephanie with Dave Madden.
I don't know.
Tara, you've got Suzanne Crow. No, Crow.
The Partridge Family.
Oh my God, there it is. Yes. Next one was Danny Bonaducci. All right, Stephanie, you're going to start us off. Seventh build, Sheila Wills.
No idea.
Okay. To Tara, Randy Brow.
Yes.
Sarah, Candy Brow.
Randy and Candy. Oh, gosh. I don't know. Pass.
To Stephanie with Linda McCullough.
Pass.
To Tara, Eric Server.
Pass.
He'll be your forever, is what he said at his wedding.
Yeah.
Sarah, Sam. Second build is Sam. Yeah.
Sam.
Oh,
people
gosh.
Love the way I say Sam.
Sam. Sam would be pass, sorry.
Number one build to Stephanie, Greg Evigan. Oh, no.
I want to say, no, I don't know.
Okay, no points on that one, but did anybody get it off that last one?
It's BJ and the Bear, right?
BJ and the Bear.
Sam God was damn the it. Yeah. Sorry, Bear.
Tara.
Yep.
Ken Strange.
Pass.
Sarah. Gary Owens.
Pass.
Stephanie Walter Brooke. Walter pass. Brooke. Lloyd Goff.
Pass.
Lloyd. All right. Wendy Wagner.
Of the Kennebunkport Wagners?
Yes.
I don't know. Pass.
Second build, Van Williams.
Pass.
And top build, Bruce Lee.
Was in a TV show? Enter the Dragon.
Nope. Anybody know it now after the last clue? Looking for the Green Hornet.
Oh.
Green Hornet.
Okay. Oh.
Sarah, start us off. Dan Milano.
Dan Milano.
Dan Milano.
No. Okay. Milano.
All right, moving on.
I don't know. Pass.
Drew Massey. Drew Massey.
Pass.
Dana Spivey Waters. Spivey.
Or Dina. No. I know who she is, but I don't know the show. Pass.
Sarah Silverman is fourth build.
BoJack Horseman?
Bob Gunton. Third build.
Gunt.
Pass.
Second build, Seth Green.
Robot Chicken. No!
And first build, Eugene Levy.
Oh my God.
Well, it's an not animal robot chicken. Species oh, in the title.
You got it.
Harvey Fishman, attorney at law, something like that. Harvey.
No, I think Tara knows it too late.
I do.
What is it?
Greg the Bunny.
Greg the Bunny.
Oh,
correct.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
God, this game is too hard.
We're at halfway-ish part. Yes. All right, Stephanie, we're starting off with you. We've got Claudia Panetta.
Pass.
Natalia Cordova Buckley.
Wow. Pass.
Ian Hart.
Yeah, I don't know. Pass. Sorry.
Gabriel Bateman.
Pass.
Logan Polish. I assume not Polish, but who knows?
Drop the dead donkeys.
Nope. Second build, Melissa George.
Whaleus?
First build, Justin Theroux.
Ooh.
I don't know. Pass.
This is Mosquito Coast.
Oh, God.
Oh, right. Oh,
my God. I was just talking about that yesterday.
Yes. All right. Jesus.
We're going to go a little faster in our second half here.
Okay.
But let's get the scores, please.
Okay. Sarah and Stephanie are looking to get on the board. I have four.
Okay. Neat. Well, let's start it up again, starting with Tara for Monty Jordan.
Pass.
Lance LeGault. Did you like the way I said that?
Just
no.
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 Pass.
Deborah Pratt.
Pass.
Jean Bruce Scott. Those are three different people.
Oh, boy. Pass.
Ernest Borgnine.
Oh my God. The single animal. I don't know.
Second build, Alex Cord.
Pass.
And number one, Dan Michael Vincent.
Oh. It's just a reach. I don't know.
That's the helicopter show.
Yeah.
Airwolf.
Airwolf. Yes. All right. Starting with Sarah. Nell Carter, seventh build.
Nell Carter. Oh, God.
I'm telling you, we're going to get to number one, and maybe that's not even going to help.
It's great.
The only one that you're going to. So if great. You want, we could just skip to number one and have Sarah guess after that.
Sure.
Because I guarantee.
Oh, no, right. That's fine. Pass.
Sarah, all right. Number one build, Claude Akins. So you're going to get it off that one or you're not, and that's it's not like exactly TV's top 100 show.
No. No, got nothing.
All right.
Tiger Tales.
Anybody know it now with all the clues?
No.
That is the Misadventures of Sheriff Lobo, or sometimes just known as Lobo.
Okay.
Oh, Jesus.
That's right. Sometimes we do Spanish clues.
No bueno.
Starting off with Stephanie, you've got Simon McCorkingdale. He's back. Wee, 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 wee. The answer is not Manimal. There's no way he would be seventh billed on Manimal. Any idea here?
Pass.
Margaret Ladd.
Pass.
Susan Sullivan.
Pass.
David Selby.
Pass.
Chow Lee Chi.
Pass.
Lorenzo Lamas, second billed.
Am I hen or not? I just don't know. I don't know.
Number one, it is Jane Wyman.
Pass.
No, no points in this one. Tara got it after.
What Falcon is it? Crest.
Falcon Crest, yes. All right, we're going to start with Tara with this one.
Yep.
Piotr Adamczyk is your first.
Pass.
Alex Ponovic.
The Americans.
Fra Fee. F-A-F-R-A-F-E-E.
Pass.
Tony Dalton.
Pass.
Vera Farmiga.
Just Farmiga.
I'm adding a little Italian mustard.
Well, she's Ukrainian, but go ahead.
But they love Italian mustard in Ukraine. Sure, that's why their top half of the flag is yellow. Bottom half.
True. I'm sorry. Who was before Farmiga?
Tony Dalton.
Tony Dalton.
Bates Motel. I don't know.
Second build, Haley Steinfeld.
Oh yeah. Okay.
I pass.
Number one, Jeremy Renner, star of Renovations.
Hawkeye.
That is Hawkeye, yes. Correct. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, you've got seventh build, good old John Bishop.
Good old John Bishop. I don't know, pass.
All right, number six, simply Joshua.
Joshua, I'm guessing that's the animal. Pass.
Next clue is number seven.
Pass.
Don Shanks, great name.
Of the Intercourse Shanks. Pass.
Bozo the Bear.
Pass.
Denver Pyle.
I had Denver Piles once. Very painful. Pass.
There's a cream for that.
Number one bill, Dan Haggerty. Haggerty. Put that T in there.
Captain Kangaroo?
No. Bozo the Bear, that was Grizzly Adams.
Grizzly Adams.
All right, going to start with Stephanie with Pat Healy.
Pass.
Pete Gardner.
Ooh. Pass.
Michael Gladys.
Oh, God. I don't know, I'm afraid.
Jack Wallace.
Pass.
Brent Gelman.
Eagleheart.
Eagleheart is correct. That was Brett. I think I might have been Brent. Yeah,
it's Brett.
Brent.
All right. Getting towards the end here. Tara.
Yeah.
Starting us off with Keith Olbermann. Keith Olbermann.
Pass.
Ooh.
Oh, shit.
Adam Conover.
I think I just got it, but.
Is this Frisky Dingo?
Paul F. Tompkins.
Pass.
Aaron Paul.
This is BoJack Horseman.
This is BoJack Horseman, yes. Nicely done. All right. Still time to catch up, guys. Sarah D. Bunting, you're starting with Robert Wisdom.
He was Bunny in The Wire, but that is not
Yeah, which is all I can think of now. So, yeah, pass.
Joe Williamson.
Pass.
Ray Liotta.
Pass.
Greg Kinnear.
This was a TV thing? Okay. Black Bird?
You are correct.
Sarah!
Thanks for Brian.
On the board. And now it's time for our last question.
Okay. I hate this game. Not as much as Stephanie hates it, but I'm a big fan.
Not my fave.
Barbara Corcoran. Corcoran? Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Pass.
Damon John. Damon John.
Shark Tank.
Shark Tank is correct. Yes. We didn't get to go to the eighth. Daniel Lebowski played Shark. There's actually a shark in Shark Tank.
They're just called sharks.
There's left shark and right shark.
Oh, I thought he was like the guy dressed up and he's like pretend to swim around this little indentation in the stage. Oh, I'm
no, very but that would improve the show.
Dang. All right. All right. Let's get these final scores.
I mean, okay.
Well, we need to hear it.
Okay.
For the record books.
Stephanie did not score. Sarah had one and I had eight.
Okay.
Some Ray Liotta bailed me out.
Eight. Lowest volume eight ever.
Eight.
All right. Congratulations.
Eight. Good job, Tara.
Thanks.
Tara.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We discussed the jogging path drama, The Beast in Me, before going around the dial with stomps at How Are You? It's Alan Partridge, Married at First Sight, and JFK.
What the doctor saw.
Yep.
Stephanie invited us all over for an awkward office dinner party canon induction. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time. Next up, it's season two of A Man on the Inside on this Friday's Extra, Extra Hot Great. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
kind of a smoky afterbirth,
Sarah D. Bunting,
I'm in hell,
and Stephanie Early Green,
snip, snap, snip, snap.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
How about a toast? Dally, here's to good friends.
Cheers.
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 That is sort of an oaky afterbirth.
What was that?
Oh, oaky, not smoky. Well, either way.
Cool. I will send that.
Great. Wow. Thank you so much.
Dog reveal.
Oh, I get him.
Oh.
Aw.
I wish this one was higher up. Because like if she actually was there. Instead of there, up here, you'd be able to see her.
You can still see her.
Yeah, I can see her butt.
That's the best part.
It's true. That is a good feature.
Okay.
We had a conversation about white dog. You don't hear dark spark often last night. Which ended with the line, yeah, you don't see dogs with ass cheeks.
Well, good night. God. That was the last thing we said to each other.
Is that like the last night of the month? You're supposed to say rabbit, rabbit, and then say hair, hair when you wake up, except now it's dog butt cheeks. Stephanie's never coming here again.
Thank you, Stephanie, for putting up with this.